Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. It's nice to have you here. A couple announcements. We will not have class tomorrow night. I've got parent-teacher conferences on Tuesday night, but starting next week is spring break, but we will have class on Monday night and Tuesday night and every night that I can foresee in the future, but there's probably something coming up. But as far as any other updates, tomorrow night's the only night we're going to miss. Otherwise, you're going to go right through spring break. Is that correct, Tony? Anything else that we can foresee? Okay. Tonight, we are going to be on in the framework book on page 209. I know I referred to it last week, but I kind of want to read through the verses tonight. And the six trials of Jesus, again, a little bit of review from last week as far as the locations. Down in this part of the city, and again, there's a better map there on your in your books that you can see. But down in this part of the city, over in here, is the kind of the metropolitan area, the suburbs of the city. They've moved west, seriously. And they're on here on Mount Zion in that area. And you're going to have the high priest mansion is going to be out in here. You're going to have, apparently, I'm putting, and many people do, John Mark's mother's house where the Last Supper is going to be held at. And again, this high priest mansion has begun, been excavated, or they've started excavating it, and they found the huge bath for the ceremonial washing with the steps, and they found a lot of luxurious types of things in this. And again, that's typical of this part of the city. Up here is, again, Fort Antonia, and Pilate was staying either here, or Pilate was staying over here in Herod's palace, Herod's fortress. This seems to be more of a place, as I look at it more and other people do, place for the garrisons to be looking at the Temple Mount of the action. This seems to be more of a place that Pilate would come, who's normally stationed Caesarea, but when things were active in Jerusalem, he would come here to kind of keep an eye on the hot spot. So he's either here or here, and that's a good discussion. That means, where's Herod? Herod Antipas from up north in Galilee. Herod could be staying here if Pilate's here. But it's also possible Herod's staying over here in another place over here, the Hasmonean Palace, or the Maccabeans. They became the kings, they're the rulers, they became the priesthood. And they have a very luxurious palace. You know, they're part of the priesthood. So Herod might be staying over here in the king's palace of the Hasmoneans. So anyway, that's just so you know, Herod's here or here, Pilate's here. In my diagrams, I've got this drawn like this. And I'll refer to this, but not necessarily even agreeing with it. I'm going to put Pilate here. I'm going to put Herod here for the evening. Annas, the godfather, the high priest that had been removed from office by the Romans because he became too politically active, became too powerful. They moved him out and brought Caiaphas in, his son-in-law who had married Annas' daughter. Caiaphas is the active high priest, but Annas is always in the picture. He's as far as making money on the temple courts, he's got a piece of the action. The Sanhedrin, I think in the book I've got the meeting on the Temple Mount. Here's the temple right here, the Temple Mount area. I've got the Sanhedrin meeting up here in one of the rooms, the official meeting rooms. It's possible they're meeting right here in another official room outside. That's been excavated also. Another large mikvah as far as for taking the ceremonial washings with the steps. We've got some pictures of that. It's buried now underneath Wilson's Arch, but you can get down there to see it. So the Sanhedrin's probably here or here. They're, anyway, when they go up here. So Jesus is going to go from Gethsemane. He's going to go into meet Annas. We're going to read through that. John 18 is where we're going to begin. You're going to see a meeting with Annas, and that's kind of like the softening him up. And then he's going to meet with Caiaphas. And a few of the Sanhedrin members are going to be there, kind of find the accusations against him. And then they kind of accused him, ready for his execution. They've got the evidence they want. I mean, it's completely set up. It's totally set up. And then at sunrise, the Sanhedrin is going to be, he's going to be brought before the Sanhedrin early in the morning. Now, several things are going to be violated here in this trial. One, he's going to be arrested late in the evening, or early in the morning, say 2 o'clock. He's going to go through a softening up case with Annas, the godfather. They're going to bring him in front of Caiaphas, who's going to find him guilty already. Now they just need to make it official. They call the Sanhedrin right when the sun comes, because you can't accuse a person of condemn him to death while it's dark out. You got to wait until the sun's rise, sun's up. Boom, you're guilty. Now they don't have permission. They don't have any jurisdiction for executing anyone. They are under Roman rule. They can follow their own religious rules and set their own speed limits and have their own taxation system as far as the temple courts and stuff. But as far as actually executing someone under Roman authority, which they're not citizens, but they're under Roman rule, they've got to get permission from Pilate. So they bring him before Pilate, and they try to accuse him before Pilate. So Pilate goes, my gosh, let's kill this man. And Pilate's too logical. He's like, well, let's look at the case. Because he's not angry. He's not involved. He's not emotionally connected. He's not being threatened by him at all. It's like, well, let's look at it. And that's a very interesting conversation. And in my opinion, I mean, I think the Annas is guilty. I think Caiaphas is guilty. I think the Sanhedrin is guilty. Of course, remember, Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, these guys are on the council of the Sanhedrin. And so they're voting no, and they're trying to somehow justify it. It would be interesting to see, and we can eventually see guys like Gamaliel, where they all come down later on in Acts. But there's definitely a trend right there of let's get this guy out of the picture. Well, then Pilate comes in, and Pilate is, in my mind, as we read through this, he's not really guilty. Again, I'm using that just as a statement. He's more like, this is wrong. This is out of control. This is, you guys are, and that's why he washes his hands and says, I don't want anything to do with this. And so he steps out of the way. So I guess you can say he's guilty for not making a stand for Christ. But it is interesting that he makes a legal stand and says, you have no case here. So the Romans kind of call it, this guy is innocent. And then they take him to Herod, or Pilate sends him over to Herod, you know, or on one of his first times saying, oh, good, I can push this off on somebody else. Herod then sends him back to Pilate. Like I said last week, remember, Jesus is going to dialogue with Pilate. He's going to talk to him. He's going to answer some questions. He's going to, in a sense, even challenge Pilate and kind of get Pilate to that place of like, okay, I think you know what you're talking about. Then they send him to Herod, and Herod, Jesus won't even, I don't want to say won't even look at him, but Herod doesn't even get a response. Jesus just stands there. It's like, meaning there's this, I'm making, again, an assumption. This guy's gone. This guy's heart is hard. This guy's too far. I'm not going to give him the honor of an answer. And Jesus just stands there. And then Herod mocks him and sends him back to Pilate. And that's where we'll read through that tonight. So you've got John 18. We'll read through those tonight. And those are the six trials that you can see. And at some point here, Jesus, someone should have stepped up and you know, stood up for Jesus. And you can see all those details we're going to go through are on that page, on page 209. So let's begin, please, in John 18, and we'll try to fly through this and see how far we get. It's interesting, again, how I just want to point out my brilliant timing. I mean, sometimes I just need to point out my genius, because we started this book in 2012, after we got back from Israel, in July. And now 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, and now Easter of 2016, I've got it timed perfectly. I just want you to know. I mean, you talk about foresight. I mean, you think sometimes I'm just winging it up here, but that's 5 years of planning that I just kind of just, you know. That's true. Yeah. Let's see. Back to reality. We still may be on this at Christmas, so. Okay, well, chapter 18 of John, verse 19. I'm going to begin in verse 12, if you don't mind. Again, we realize Jesus has been arrested in Gethsemane. The battalion of soldiers have been sent out by the high priest, and they come down here, apparently, probably to John Mark's house looking for Jesus, and he's not there, so they probably go out. Judas probably led them back to here, because remember, he left during the supper, and this is the last place he saw him. Then he goes, well, if they're not here, they're probably out here at the place where they normally stayed. I'll throw this in there, we've talked about it before. The man that is going to be in the book of John that is hiding in the bushes and runs away, it's a very likely, at least it's presentable, that that's John Mark, a young man who was woken up when the soldiers came to the house, and he hears what the commotion, and then the battalion of soldiers with Judas goes out, and John Mark follows him in his bed clothes, basically goes out and sees what's going on right here. And then when they see him, they grab his bed clothes and he ran away. And that's recorded in Mark's account. And that would be where we'd see that. Okay, here we go. John chapter 18, verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers with his commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. So again, we've got people sent there from, there's some Jewish officials, there's some high priest officials there. They bound him and brought him first, John says right there, you see it right there, first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas is the active high priest. He's got the official position. But Annas was the old man who was really, according to Jewish law, should still be the high priest. But the Romans got so tired of him manipulating the system and going behind their backs and rising up the people again, they just says, you're done. And the Romans pull him out of position, says, find someone else. So his son-in-law takes the position. So Annas is really, in the Jewish eyes, has the power. I call him the godfather. He's behind everything that takes place, but the Romans won't give him any position. Caiaphas has the actual power. So, of course, if you're going to begin the system, you start with the godfather, Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. Remember, in their inner council, he says, it's better if one man dies than the whole nation perishes. And that's their motive for killing or executing Jesus, so that there's not a revolt, that the Romans come in and squelch the revolt and then destroy Jerusalem, which is going to happen in 70 AD because the Romans or the Jews are going to do the very thing that they tried to avoid here. They're going to find a Messiah or a false Messiah and follow him to their destruction. And that's what they're afraid of, following a false Messiah here. Verse 15, Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus because the disciple was known, because this disciple, that would be John who's writing this account, was known to the high priest. He went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. That's into the palace of the high priest down here in the wealthy part of town. But Peter had to wait outside at the door because he wasn't known to who he was. The other disciples who was known, John, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. So John gets Peter in, got him a VP pass, got him to go, you know, backstage. You are not one of his disciples, are you? The girl at the door asked Peter. And there's his, again, you know, the denials. You are not one of his disciples. No, I'm not. I'm here with the press. I'm just here to get some info. I'm just here covering the story. It's like, why do you want to come in? Are you one of his disciples? Why are you here? Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just observing. I'm just a concerned citizen. He replied, I am not. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. So, again, you can see it's right around April, April 1st, you know, Nisan 1st, or 14th of Nisan, around our April 1st. So, again, it's got a cool night, so there's a fire to keep themselves warm. They had made. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. Meanwhile, the high priest, right here in my NIV, it says high priest, which you'd think that would be Caiaphas, but again, in this account, I believe it's Annas right here, questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Two things he's questioning. Where are your disciples? Who are your disciples? Who's following me? Who's the rebels? Where's the terrorists? Where's the freedom fighters? Who are they? Name them. We need names. And your teaching. What are you teaching? Again, we're not talking like Christian doctrine. Teaching. What are you trying to motivate? What are you trying to get them to do? What is your goal? He's trying to get him one. He's trying to get a list of names and trying to find fault in as far as a rebellious attitude, or not an attitude, but a rebellious. And again, there have been messiahs, false messiahs come that rose people up in rebellion towards the Jews and the Romans, and they anticipate that Jesus is one of them. So they want evidence. Now watch Jesus. Please listen to Jesus speak. They ask him questions about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus says, I've spoken openly to the world, meaning all my stuff's online. You want to hear one of my, all my videos are online. Go. I'm not going to do your research for you. Go listen to it. Read the transcripts. I mean, it's out there. In other words, what they're asking him to do right here is accuse himself. Tell us about your teaching. Well, I'm telling this. Ah, we found it. We got enough evidence. It's like, no. In a court case, and follow this, in a court case that Jesus is involved in, they're asking him, it's against the law of Moses, it's against common sense, it's against even our own law. They're trying to get him to accuse himself. It's like, I'm not going to do your work for you. If you've got an accusation against me, go find it. Go get proof. Go get your witnesses. I'm not going to say that. I've spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogue. He doesn't answer the question. He tells them, here's where you can get your information. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple. I mean, we see him repeatedly presenting his information at the synagogue. We see him arguing and making his presentation, teaching, not just arguing, but teaching and explaining the kingdom of God on the Temple Mount. The Sanhedrin had heard him. Where all the Jews come together. Everybody's heard me teach. I said nothing in secret. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't teach his disciples privately, but there's nothing I told my disciples privately that I didn't say publicly. There's not going to be any hidden information, no hidden agenda. I spoke in synagogues. I spoke on the Temple Mount. You people have heard me. Why question, in other words, why question me? Ask those who heard me. If you've got a problem, go ask them. Go bring them in here. Let's hear them. Have them accuse me. I'll defend myself. Surely they know what I said. You understand? That was I don't want to say defiant, but yeah, it wasn't. He didn't answer the question. Well, here's my teaching. He's like, hey, he's actually telling the Godfather, listen, you're asking me to tell you something that you already know. The Sanhedrin knows, the Jews from Galilee down to Judea, from synagogue to synagogue to the Temple Mount, they've heard me say it. Go ask them. Now, does that upset the high priest? When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest, he demanded. Now, notice right there. It's like they understood what Jesus had said. He wasn't saying, well, you know, he told him, go get your own information. And they slapped him. It's like, we want an answer. Now, watch Jesus. If I said something wrong, testify to what is wrong. He says, now either he's referring to all of his teaching. If I taught something wrong, tell me about it. I think he's referring to he just got slapped in court. It's like you're in front of the high priest, the Godfather. He asks you, he says, well, go get your own information. They slap him. It's like, whoa. He says, if I said something wrong, testify what is wrong. What did I say that was wrong? I just says, my teaching's out there. I've said nothing in secret. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? In other words, if I'm waiting here for my case. In other words, you have just struck me as if I'm guilty, and the case hasn't even begun. Why did you strike me? Just remember, when people ask it, turn the other cheek, turn the other cheek. There's a place and time for turning the other cheek. But this apparently isn't one of those times. Because Jesus didn't turn the other cheek, say, I'm sorry, hit me again. He says, whoa, whoa. I'm in a court case with the Godfather, the former high priest, and I just gave you an honest answer. It says, go do your own work, and you slap me. Now, if I did something wrong, tell me what it was. But if I didn't say anything wrong, why did you slap me? He says, I call foul. This case is now wrong. Right from the very beginning, Jesus is saying, this case is out of control already. Jesus is following the law. He's following common sense. Okay. Then Annas sent him still bound to Caiaphas. Do notice, he's bound like a criminal. He's being slapped like he's guilty. He's being questioned to accuse himself, and Jesus doesn't accuse himself. He says, what am I doing wrong? They send him bound. Annas, the Godfather, couldn't break him, so it's like, okay, we're moving into the Sanhedrin. Part of this, again, Caiaphas and some of the Sanhedrin have now assembled, and they're in the vicinity right here. They're maybe in another room. That maybe this Annas has got him in some special room in the house, you know, maybe the living room, maybe the kitchen, maybe, I don't know, banquet hall, whatever. Now, some of the Sanhedrin have met with the high priest. They've gotten up early with Caiaphas, and now they're ready for another mock trial. This really wasn't a trial as much as it was softening him up. Then Annas sent him still bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, from there, we're going to go to 24. I'll go ahead and read this right here. As Simon Peter stood warming himself, he was asked, you are not one of his disciples, are you? Now he's standing around the barrel warming himself. He denied it, saying, I am not. One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him, didn't I see you out in the olive grove? I saw you were the one that cut my cousin's ear off. It's like, again, Peter denied it, and at that moment, the rooster began to crow. So now you know what time of day it is. The rooster began to crow. And Peter, coming into the high priest's palace, denies Jesus. Standing around warming himself, denies Jesus. Then someone says, yeah, you cut off my cousin's ear. Oh, what? I just woke up. And so he's denying, I have nothing to do with this. And of course, Peter's going to be broken. He's going to deny. Peter is going to come back. And if you read 1 and 2 Peter, especially 1 Peter, you can hear Peter encouraging words, I think, tied right into this situation of how, you know, stay strong and return. You stay in the faith. Okay, verse 28. Then the Jews led Jesus. I'm going to read right here, and then eventually we're going to jump over to Matthew so we can see it again. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. Now, see that jump right there? They just said he went to Caiaphas, but they don't give any details. Then John jumps from the Caiaphas trial right to being led to the governor's mansion. By now it was early morning. So I need to go to Matthew 26, please. Matthew 26, if you don't mind. Matthew 26, verse 57. And if you look in Matthew 26, you can see beginning in verse 47. There you've got Jesus being arrested, the 12 scattering. And then in verse 57 of Matthew 26, those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. Do you see the difference right there? Now, some people want to, you know, they want to put those together, but I'm pretty confident he's meeting with Annas. And then John says, then they led him to Caiaphas. Matthew skips this meeting with the Godfather, goes right to Caiaphas. John talks about Annas and says Annas sends him to Caiaphas. So there's really no trouble here at all, just that this part isn't covered by Matthew. But notice who's there with Caiaphas. It says right here, the high priest, where the teachers of the law, that'd be the Sanhedrin, and the elders were all met together. So these are the leaders. And I don't think that's everybody. The whole Sanhedrin isn't assembled at the high priest's mansion. They're going to be assembled here, and that's going to be at sunrise, I think. You can keep thinking. But Peter followed him at a distance right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down to the guards to see the outcome. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. Now, again, there it says the whole Sanhedrin. Now, does that mean the whole Sanhedrin's there? It could be that everybody got up and is crowded in here. Or it could be tying these two events together. Or it could say that's their motive, but they're not all there present. So keep that in mind. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. So Jesus tells Annas, where's your witnesses? Well, now, here they come. They're going to bring in some false witnesses. But their stories are not going to collaborate. They're not going to work together. They're not going to fit. Now, who's defending Jesus? I don't know what Jesus is saying in this situation here, but they can't. None of the accusations will stick because they're false. Once they start questioning, maybe Nicodemus or Josephus or Joseph of Arimathea, maybe they're the ones questioning the witnesses. You know, they're trying to do an honest job of it, and nothing sticks. Finally, it says two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Now, that goes way back to the beginning of the book of John. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer?" That kind of gives you a picture of what Jesus maybe isn't saying. Maybe he's just standing there. "What is this testimony that these men are bringing in against you?" But Jesus remained silent. So I think we're safe to assume that Jesus isn't defending himself. Why are the earlier witnesses, the false evidence, not sticking? It's got to be coming from someone who's proving them wrong. And it appears that Jesus is just standing there. And now the high priest right here is standing up. You can see he's getting agitated. He's getting irritated. So he's standing up and he's apparently kind of getting in Jesus' face. The high priest Caiaphas, whose tomb they have discovered. Remember, his sarcophagus has been discovered. But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath." Now, that's interesting. He now puts Jesus under oath. You now have to respond. "By the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Now, this is all these different accusations about tearing down the temple. Again, that was a false interpretation of what Jesus said. He didn't say, "I'm going to tear down the temple and rebuild it in 3 days," the building. He's talking about his body, you know, a whole other explanation, as we can find out. But now they say, "Tell us plainly, are you the Messiah that we're waiting for? Are you the Son of God?" Okay, now Jesus, under oath, is asked a point-blank question to identify himself. This apparently is something that Jesus feels comfortable answering. When I was a kid it's a Methodist church, but it could be any church, I remember hearing from the pulpit, nowhere in the Bible does Jesus clearly say he's the Son of God. He knew that he was just a good Jewish man, a good follower of God. And there were some very poor teaching in that church. And again, it could be any church. It just happened to be back in the 70s. And for a long time, I knew that Jesus was the Son of God because that was what I believed, you know, as a teenager. But I kind of thought I was on shaky ground because it's like, I kind of know Jesus is the Son of God. And how do you know that kind of stuff? Because you just kind of feel it, you know, mystical. It's my faith. Until I got into the Bible, like in the 80s, I started reading. It's like, oh my gosh, here it is. Jesus, well, you decide. You tell us plainly, are you the Christ, the Son of God? Jesus says, well, I really don't want to make a commitment. I want everyone to kind of have their own experience and feel the presence of God. I want each person to find their own way to God. I don't want to get in the way.
which is kind of what I thought he probably said, because no one knew for sure. Well, verse 66. Yes, he says, it is as you say. What did he just say? Are you the Christ, the Son of God? It's like, yes, it is as you say. Say what? I am the Christ, the Son of God. I mean, okay. Yes, it is as you say. I'm going to read this note I've got in my Bible that I wrote. In some exegetical study, I wrote this note. This, yes, it is as you say, is a formula answer that means yes, but that's not how I would say it. In other words, yes, you've got it, but I would say it a little differently to be a little more precise. And then he says, and it fits, because he says, because the next line here in my NIV, again, you've got your own text right there, in the NIV it says, but I say to all of you. So in other words, yes, it is as you say, which is a formula that means yes, but that's not how I would say it. In other words, I would say it like this. I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Mighty One and coming in the clouds of heaven. Or the clouds. In other words, yes, but that's not how I would say it. I would say it, I'm the one that Daniel spoke about who's coming back in glory to bring judgment on the earth. Maybe that clears it up. In other words, it's, you know, Son of God, you can do a lot of things with that. Messiah, yeah, you know, Son of David, you can do a lot of things with that. But yeah, it can get kind of confusing. Let's just say I'm the one who's going to come back in God's glory and bring judgment to the earth. Well, it says right here, I say to you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on clouds of glory. Now, how did the high priest hear that? Was he like, I don't know, what did he say? I mean, that's kind of like a riddle. I mean, how do we figure that out? Did the high priest understand what he said? Well, read the next verse. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? That's exactly what, let's just cut to the chase. I am God, the one that we're waiting for to come back in judgment. He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? We don't need anybody else. We've got everybody here, the members of the Sanhedrin, the elders, myself. We've heard him say to himself, let's take this now and testify before the Sanhedrin what he has just said. They've got what they wanted. Again, he tore his clothes. Remember, the high priest has got some kind of high priestly garments on. He's already standing up. He's already in Jesus' face at some level. I'm not sure how close he is to him. He's now, and he's challenging him. Jesus challenges him right back and says, yes, but that's not how I would say it. I would say it more like Daniel said it and quotes scripture back to him and says, that's me. The high priest tears his clothes and says, that's blasphemy. You think I'm talking to God face to face here, basically. He says, why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? Asking for a judgment. Sanhedrin, who's here? What do you think? He is worthy of death, they answered. Then they spit in his face, struck him with their hands. Others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you? Now this appears to be right there in the high priest's mansion. This is going to deteriorate on our way through here. So that's Matthew 26. We can read more about this. I'm going to jump now to Luke 22, please, if you don't mind. Luke 22. Luke 22, beginning in verse 63. Luke 22, verse 63. And you can hear this kind of picks up right where we left off in Matthew. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. Apparently at the high priest's mansion. They blindfolded him and demanded, prophesy, who hit you? And that's exactly what we see in Matthew. And they said many other insulting things to him. Verse 66, they're waiting for this moment. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together. That now, see, there that was at the high priest. They're mocking him, beating him, blindfolding him. But they're waiting for what? They're waiting for the sun. Remember, the roosters crowed, but they're waiting for the sun to rise so they can have an official meeting of the Sanhedrin because they want to follow the law.
So they want to make sure they have an official meeting. The Sanhedrin is going to meet here or here. Again, the idea is there. So they lead him from here. That he's met with Annas. He's met with Caiaphas. And I think a few members of the Sanhedrin. I don't think all of them were there. I'm not going to, it just doesn't seem possible to have everybody there because that's what's going to take place here. Now they're going to lead him with they had enough Sanhedrin members there to hear his testimony so they can now stand in front of the whole Sanhedrin and have two or three or more witnesses say, we heard him say this. So they don't need any, what did we hear in the synagogues? What did we hear in the Temple Mount? What did they say about the temple being destroyed and rebuilt? We heard him say that he's going to come in clouds of glory. We heard him say that. So now they're going to follow him up here. And when the sun comes up, the Sanhedrin can have an official meeting. And here it begins. Verse 66. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. If you are the Christ, they said, tell us. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe. In other words, now they're going to say, do what you did now in front of the Sanhedrin, what you did down at the high priest's mansion. Tell us. He says, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. They all asked, are you the Son of God? He replied, you are right in saying, I am. And that's as fast as you can get through a court case. It's like, there it is. He said, if I told you, you won't believe me. But he says, it is. He said, are you okay? Are you the Son? They push it one more. Are you the Son of God? You are right in saying, I am. Yes. I mean, there's no flip-flop, wishy-washy, well, I don't want to... It's just like, yes, it is as you say. I was the one who said, I am the Son of God. I am the Messiah. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? Down here, why do we need any more witnesses? Now in here, why do we need any more testimony? We don't need to hear what you guys heard down here because he just said in front of all of us. He says he's the Son of God. I lost my place. Okay, you're right in saying, well, why do we need more things? We have heard it from his own lips. Again, remember right here, they're looking for witnesses. They take these witnesses up here, and they ask him the question, and he testifies himself, and they say, we don't need you guys. We heard it from his own lips. The whole Sanhedrin heard him say, I am the Son of God. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. Again, now the Sanhedrin's had him. Now they've decided he's worthy of death. So this is early in the morning. The sun has just come up, and remember, Pilate is still waking up. His wife is still in bed, and she's going to come out and say, I just had a terrible dream about this guy. So it's early in the morning. The sun has just come up. They lead him to Fort Antonius, what I've got on the map. If Pilate's staying over here in Herod's palace, then they led him over here. Or maybe some other place that I haven't identified. I lost my place again. Okay, chapter 23. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. Really? Give me a verse on that. Where did you... He says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. He is as neutral as Jesus is going to be on that. It's like, you owe Caesar taxes, but you owe God something too. I'm not here to tell you to pay taxes to Caesar or not, but it's his money. You better, he's governing you. He's paying for your roads. He's paying for your lead of government. You better pay Caesar his coinage. But what I'm here to talk about is what you owe God. So if anything, he says, pay taxes to Caesar. He opposes payment to taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ a king. Now in Pilate's ears, Christ a king means he's challenging Rome. And this is where they're going to try to get, this is where they're going to get Pilate kind of in a corner, because they understand Jesus, the Jews understand Jesus as being the Son of God, the Anointed One, the Messiah, and the things he's going to do. But now they're going to just take a little portion of that and bring it over to Pilate. Says, he thinks he's a king. In other words, he wants to oppose Caesar's taxation. He thinks he's the king. Basically, he wants to overthrow Caesar. What are you going to do with that, Pilate? They don't tell him the whole story. And again, Pilate's trying to process Jewish culture, Jewish law. So Pilate asks Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? Now what's the answer to that? Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus says, yes, it is as you say. Are you the Son of God? Yes, it is as you say. Now, are you the king of the Jews? Yes, I am. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and crowd, I find no basis for charge against the man.
But they insisted. He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here. This blasphemous teaching started way up there in Galilee, no man's land, and it's made its way here. And if it's come that far, who knows where it's going to stop? We got to put a stop to this now, Pilate, because it's going to corrupt the whole nation. And then you're going to have a problem. On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. Did you say he started in Galilee? When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod. Oh, good. All right, well then let's pass the buck. Let's send this over to Congress and have Congress make the decision. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. Before the feast, it's Herod Antipas. He's either staying here at his father's palace, or he's over here in the Hasmonean palace. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because he had been wanting to see him. Jesus has been on the cover of People magazine. He's been on, all the celebrity shows, all the talk shows, and I've never had a chance to meet him, and yet he's from my own country. I mean, he grew in popularity and got out of my country before I had a chance to actually sit down and talk with the guy. So, wow, Jesus, finally, we get a chance to meet. Can we get a selfie together? Or whatever. Okay. Herod was pleased to meet him. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. So Jesus is a celebrity. You understand? Jesus has celebrity status. You may like him, you may not like him, but he's still a celebrity. Name somebody, some villain, popular person. You may say, I don't like them, but if they were, in the restaurant next to you, you may want to stop and just kind of peek at him and say, I saw him, I hate him, but look at him, I got a picture of him, look at me and them, I got a selfie with him. It's like, I hate this person, but they're a celebrity. Happens to me all the time. Well, I teach at a middle school, so I'm pretty popular. Some days, depending on how class went. Yeah, okay, anyway. I know what it's like to be a celebrity amongst 12-year-olds. Herod's jurisdiction, okay, he was pleased to see him. From what he had heard about him, look at this. This is why Jesus doesn't talk to him, I think. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. I hear you do miracles on command. I'd like to see a couple tricks. He plied him with many questions. Now, we don't necessarily know these questions, but many questions. He's trying to break through Jesus. It's like asking him some kind of question. It's probably celebrity-like questions. But Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. So in other words, they'd come with him over with Herod. And so they're now accused. They're following Jesus around trying to get someone to commit to crucifying him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him because he's just standing there. He's being accused by the chief priests, the elders. He's being mocked by the soldiers. He's being mocked by Herod, and he's just standing there. Then Herod, dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. In other words, and they're mocking him. They put some kind of royal robe on him and send him back to Pilate. And Pilate, of course, like, oh. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. They had been political enemies, but like so often, enemies found a place to unite because they're both against the same situation. Pilate called together the chief priests and rulers of the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him." I've asked him questions. He says, I see nothing in him that he's trying to lead a rebellion against you and your nation. Neither has Herod. Why? Because if Herod had found something wrong with him, he wouldn't have sent him back. Herod would have taken care of it. He's got jurisdiction under Roman authority as the king of Galilee and the area up in there. He's got jurisdiction. But Herod sends him back. I'm done with him. He won't give me any information. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. So he's been declared innocent by Pilate. He's been declared innocent by Herod. How do we know? Because he sent him back. If he'd wanted to charge him with something, he would have followed him with some kind of letter. He would have taken care of the execution himself. But he sends him back. So Herod, Pilate, they're seeing nothing wrong with the man. There's only this group that wants him killed because of, the religious connotations. Neither is Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him, then release him. I will punish him for causing this uproar, getting me up early in the morning,
and then I'm going to release him because there's nothing to hold him on. There's not even a parking ticket. With one voice they cried out, away with this man, release Barabbas to us. And they talk about Barabbas, who was the criminal. Now, I want to go to, where do I want to go to? Is it back in John? I think I want to go back to John. I don't have it written up here. Go back to John, see if I can find it here. And you guys probably know where it's at. Because when Jesus talks to Pilate when he comes back, where he talks about truth. Yes. So I'm going to go back to John 18, verse 28. Now, as we read through this, remember, he appears before Pilate. Pilate sends him to Herod, and he finds out he's from Galilee. Herod sends him back to Pilate. So this conversation is either on the front side or the back side of this. But Pilate's going to declare him innocent and say, I'm going to beat him. But there's going to be a rising up, and the Jews are going to say, well, they're going to threaten Pilate, basically. Remember, Pilate is a man with authority, but he's also a man under authority. And you've all been in positions like this. I'm in charge of my little shop. I tell the kids I'm the god of the shop. This is like my little universe. I rule the shop. That sounds good until you realize, but I'm in somebody else's universe too. I'm a planet orbiting the whole school system. I got a principal, I've got a superintendent, I've got a school board, I've got the state of Iowa, I've got federal law. So it's like, yeah, my universe is pretty small. I'm kind of like just a demigod. But to them, I am in charge. You understand? And the same thing, Pilate is a man in charge, but he's also got authorities over him. And what they're going to do, just like if the kids are smart, and they haven't for a long time, but they can do this, I'm going to tell my mom. Okay, but I'll call your mom first. I'm going to tell the principal. Well, now how's the principal going to respond? Well, I've already talked to the principal about the problem. It's like they can just keep, I'm going to find an authority above you that's going to agree with the child story. And usually, I keep it pretty level that it's like, they're going to be on my side all the way up. But Pilate has already gotten himself in trouble. Imagine the teacher who's gotten himself in trouble, and they say, I'm going to go back up and accuse you of something you've already been accused of. It's like, uh-oh. And Pilate's been accused of some things, and he's gotten in trouble. And that's why he's on the backside of the Roman Empire in Judea. This is not a glorious place to be in charge of. And they're going to say, we're going to tell Caesar, or the emperor. And when Pilate hears that, it's like, oh, man. And Pilate does his life, doesn't he? Ends in exile. Him, his wife, end in exile. It doesn't end well for him. So, I mean, he was in trouble already. That's why he's on this side of the empire. So, that's how this is going to end. We're in now chapter 18, verse 28. Pilate, I think, made a good decision on Jesus. He's calling him innocent. But what's going to end up happening is they're going to go above his head, and he's going to realize, I could lose everything if I don't just give in and maybe bury this situation. It'll be easier to kill Jesus and protect myself than have the Jews rise up in rebellion and tell Caesar that I'm leading a rebellion here. In other words, they're accusing Pilate of being on Jesus' side and Jesus leading a rebellion. And we'll go tell them that you're helping instigate a rebellion against Rome with Jesus. So listen to it yourself. Chapter 18, verse 28. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning. Now notice John skips the Sanhedrin and goes from that palace right to Pilate. He's also going to skip the Herod confrontation. It was early morning. And to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews did not enter the palace. See, there it says palace. This is Fort Antonia. This is the palace. So it gives the impression here, I would say, they're more like just talking about Pilate's down here. So Pilate came out to them and asked, and again, we can see the remains of this palace. We can see this is right there by the Joppa Gate right there today. So Pilate came out to them and asked, again, remember, this is at the very beginning when he first sees Jesus and goes through his whole time with Jesus. What charges are you bringing against this man? They say, if he were not a criminal, they replied, we would not have handed him over to you. Don't ask us these detailed questions. We've already had a court case. He's guilty. We just want him executed. It's like, well, for what? Why question us? We're telling you we've made our decision. Pilate, just kill the guy. So, interesting. If he weren't, why would we wake you up and ask you for a decision? If he's a criminal, kill him. Pilate says, take him yourself and judge him by your own law, which they basically have already done. Falsely, but they've accused him according to their own law. They says, but we have no right to execute anyone. We've found him guilty of capital punishment, but we don't have that right.
This happened so that the words of Jesus had spoken indicated the kind of death that he was going to die would be fulfilled. What kind of death would the Jews have given him? Stoning. But Jesus says, I'll be lifted up. I'll be crucified. So now, in other words, he knows all this. If the Jews had taken him out like... Listen, what's interesting is the Jews somehow got Stephen outside. They stoned Stephen to death in 34, 35 A.D. Stephen was stoned to death in just a few years. But why couldn't they stone Jesus to death? One time they picked up stones on the Temple Mount to stone him. So they're not above stoning. Remember, the woman that was being caught in adultery was getting ready to be stoned. So, I mean, it's a law, but you can see certain cracks in that they are stoning certain people. I don't know, and sweeping it under the rug, you know? I mean, covering it up. It's like, what's going on here? Oh, no, we're just having a little dance party, you know, get rid of the body. You know, it's like they could stone somebody and no one really find out about it. I don't know. But anyway, Jesus says that he was going to die of crucifixion, which is a Roman punishment. That's how the Romans, I'll say this, you know this, but the Romans crucified slaves and non-citizens. They decapitated citizens who were worthy of capital punishment. Thus, Jesus is crucified, Peter is crucified, Paul decapitated, because Paul was a Roman citizen. So, I mean, that's just kind of interesting to put that all together. So, Jesus is crucified as a criminal or as a non-Roman citizen, and that's where Jesus says what kind of death he'd have. Verse 33, Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Is that, he said, then watch Jesus' dialogue with him. Is that your own idea, or did others talk to you about me? He says, have you come to that conclusion on your own, or are you just repeating what you've heard? In other words, is that not interesting? I mean, for me, that's amazing. Herod, he just stands there. It's like, nothing. I'm not even going to help you. You're going to perish. But Pilate, Jesus... I'm just talking about Jesus as God, how he's responding to individuals. He's responding to Herod like, there's not a chance in the world. I'm not even going to try. Again, I'm reading the situation. I may be overstating it. But with Pilate, it seems like there's a flicker of seeking truth. It's like, you're the king of the Jews. He says, now, is that what you've come to conclude, or is that you're just telling me what other people have told you? Now watch Pilate kind of throws the wall up. Am I a Jew? Pilate replied. It was your own people, your own chief priest who handed you over to me. What is it you have done? He said, I don't know anything about this. I don't know what the king of the Jews looks like. He says, it was your own people. He says, what is it you have done? Now watch Jesus continues to die. He'll just stand there and go, someday you'll see me come in clouds of glory. He says, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants or officers would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. In other words, yeah, he says, my kingdom, he says, it's not of this world. He says, if it were, I wouldn't be standing here in front of you. I'd have forces. I'd have my military defending me. But it's not of this world. But now my kingdom is from another place. Now this has got Pilate completely intrigued. So you are a king then. Jesus, you're right in saying, I am a king. Yes, I am a king. I mean, this is beautiful stuff, I think. He says, yeah, I am a king. But there's nothing for you to worry about. I'm not here to overthrow your kingdom. Because why? Because Jesus is the one who's in charge of history. I mean, in other words, well, he's going to say it here already. But Jesus is here on another mission. He's not threatened by Pilate, nor is he threatening Pilate, because actually Jesus is the one who put Pilate in place. Correct? It's like, I'm not trying to take you out of power. And now Pilate doesn't understand, but Jesus is like, I put you here. He's going to say that. You are right in saying that I'm a king. In fact, for this reason, I was born, and for this reason, I came into the world to testify to the truth. The truth of what? About the bigger kingdom. I came for this. The very reason I was born was to testify about this kingdom, the truth of this kingdom, the eternal kingdom, the kingdom that will never pass away, the kingdom that the stone will grow into a mountain that will cover the earth, the stone that comes from an uncut hand, was not cut by the hands of men, it was eternal. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. And what's interesting here is, and Pilate, are you on the side of truth? Because, I mean, you're listening to me. You're not mocking me. You're actually listening to me. So,
Which way are we going to go? Pilate dismisses this right here. What is truth? Pilate asked. Now, what you have right here, we could go off on this, and this is an important verse. What is truth? Jesus presents truth, and this should be important for us. Jesus presents truth. He's testifying to truth, this eternal truth, this absolute reality. It's a reality. It's a truth. It's undeniable. This is truth. And Pilate comes back with something that our culture is familiar with. Yeah, what's truth? I mean, everyone finds their own truth. It's relative. Depending on, Jesus said, no. I'm telling you about reality, the absolute, the rock bottom truth. And that's what I'm here to testify about. There is an absolute reality. And Pilate's like, yeah, we're all looking for truth. Who knows? Everybody's got their own truth. And it's like, oh, so close. They use truth on two different ways. And our culture, and it's we can see it in it when we talk about, like, in the Titanic Faith book, the postmodern era, the modern and the postmodern, as far as we're in that age now where there's no absolutes. There's no absolutes. What used to be nice, there used to be an absolute from, you know, like when we grew up going back to the 1500s, there was science. And science got us into secular humanity. The only thing that was truth, absolute, was something that could be tested. Science. Well, we've moved on past that. It'd be nice to be able to go back to that age of modern philosophy where things were absolute. You can test it. This is a chair. You are a boy. I mean, some absolute reality. We've gone past that now, and there's no absolutes. It's like you're not sure of anything. Everything is in a state of flux. We're in a very dangerous place. And you can see that right here. He says, everyone on the side of truth listens to me because Jesus is the Word. He is the creator of reality. He is the Word made flesh. I'm absolute reality, is what Jesus said. We can see that in Paul's writings. What is truth? Pilate asked. With this, he went out again to the Jews and says, I find no basis for a charge against him. This man is not a threat. In fact, you might want to pay attention to him. He doesn't say that. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews? He says, listen, we can get out of this and make everybody happy. There is a clause. There is a back door. I can charge him, which would make you happy, but I can also release him, because I always give you a someone's released as a testimony. We release one of your prisoners, and as kind of like to make me happy. So this would be the one I give you, but yet I'll accuse him of being guilty, and we're all good. Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? They shouted back, no, not him. Give us Barabbas. Now, Barabbas had taken part in a rebellion. In other words, Barabbas was a rebel. Barabbas was a terrorist, not on the side of truth, but in the side of some kind of a rebellious attack on Rome or the Jewish government in the Roman system. He was a rebel. He was a problem. And they say, give us a real rebel, and we want you to kill the king of the Jews, the absolute truth, the one who came to testify. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. Now, again, you can read through this, how this all goes. It would appear with Pilate's dialogue that he is not wanting. He already offered, I'll beat him, and then we'll let him go. Okay, well, just, I'll beat him. He gave him several options. Okay, you think he's guilty. I don't think he's guilty. But kind of meet you halfway, I'll beat him, and then we'll send him back. Okay? I'll call him guilty, but I'll release him as the prisoner as goodwill towards you. So you'll call him guilty, I'll set him free. So he's given them several options where they can be happy and he can be happy and not really be guilty. So many people have presented this also. This flogging, that this is like Pilate's last attempt. You don't have to accept this. Pilate just a very, very cruel man, just wants to just beat Jesus to the pulp. But that doesn't sound like Pilate's direction here. So it is worth considering, and you probably have already, that Pilate is just taking Jesus and hoping to just get some public sympathy. Just beat the man. Is that enough? Well, keep hitting him. Ripping him up. It's like there's nothing left of him. Can we let him go now? And these people are going to go the whole way with it. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, Hail, King of the Jews! And they struck him on the face.
Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the robe, the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." Here is the man you're accusing. Here he is. Look what I've done to him. Good enough? Here's the man right here. Look what I've done. What else could we do to him? I mean, we've mocked him. We've got him beaten. We're spitting on him. It's like he's almost dead. As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify him, crucify him." In other words, not good enough. We want the man, not just mocked, not just beaten, not just publicly ridiculed. We want him nailed on a cross until he's dead. Pilate's like, my gosh, these people. Again, that's how I think this is going. As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. I'm not going to do it, you crazy people. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." Now here's where they hit him. The Jews insisted, "We have a law, and according to the law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside because now he realizes he's claiming, he talks about a kingdom, not of this place. Now the crowd is testifying, he claims to be the Son of God. Now this lands in Pilate's head because he's from a culture that this is some kind of a reality. Now again, does he understand him being the unique, only Son of God? Probably not. But it's like he's from another place. He's got heritage. He's got family from another dimension. It's like, oh my gosh. Because Pilate knows something's going on with this guy. His composure, his answers, his dialogue. He went back inside to the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus. But Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate says. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Now this goes back to what we said earlier. Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given you from above," which above would be from Jesus himself. He says, "I'm no threat to you because you wouldn't even be in this position if I hadn't put you in this position. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of the greater sin." And then he doesn't say you're innocent, because if you want to take a stand for truth, he said, anyone on the side of truth listens to me. And I'm telling you the truth. You're going to have to go the way of a disciple, Pilate, which is going to be you're going to lose. Meaning Pilate says, I don't want to lose. You're going to have to follow me. Peter's going to die. Paul's going to die. James is going to die. They're all going to suffer. You want to listen to me? Those who follow the truth will listen to me. He says, "Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of the greater sin." Pilate is still not innocent because he didn't side with the truth, but he's not the one who instigated the attack against the truth. And you understand that. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free again. But the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." Let us make this clear, Pilate. He says he's a king, and if anyone says they're a king, they're opposing your boss, Caesar. Do you want to go there, Pilate? No, I don't want to go there. And that's what they say. When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down at the judge's seat at the place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of Passover week, about the sixth hour. Now again, this stone pavement has been identified over in this area here. We've got it identified here. You can see it. But it's not, that doesn't have, doesn't, isn't marked, you know, or there's probably a sign there, obviously. But that stone pavement could be here, where he comes out. There could be over here. So that's not a slam dunk. That just identifies the stone pavement. And here's Pilate. "Here is your king." Again, he says, "Here's your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, take him away, crucify him. "Shall I crucify your king?" And now I don't think he's mocking. I do not think Pilate is mocking Jesus. You can go there. But Pilate's done too much to right now cave in and start mocking him. I think if he's mocking anybody, he's mocking the Jews. It's like, this guy's your king. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priest answered. The very people that said, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not, is now swearing allegiance to Caesar over Jesus Christ. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is Golgotha. Now, we'll have to wrap this up here. Let me see what time it's getting to be here. It's time to wrap it up. This place is, and I personally have no doubt about this. That doesn't mean you shouldn't. You should think about it. You can, you know. But there's this place called the skull. Again, I don't want to make you mad or discredit anything. There's this place up here north where you see the pictures in your Bible handbook and stuff. The place looks like a skull right here. It's called the Garden Tomb. I just forgot the name of the guy from England that discovered it. But anyway, does anybody know our handbook? The Garden Tomb. Who discovered that? I forgot. Who? Yeah, Golgotha, right. But I mean the man who found it, the English guy. I don't think this is not it. I don't. If you've ever gone to Jerusalem, and they'll take you there, and they'll share communion with you in the nice little, they got little trees there, and there is an ancient tomb there, and it's very peaceful. We didn't go there, did we go there? No. We've gone there, and then I went out there while we were there together. I went up all the way up into the city one Sunday. I walked away down this wall and stuff. I went there again, got some more pictures. But it's a very peaceful place, and they'll serve you communion, and it's peaceful and quiet, and you have that moment of reflection, and you just feel the presence of God, and you just know this is the place. Until you actually do archaeological work, and the tomb is from like 700 BC. It's not the right place. The Crusaders identified it, but they didn't know what they were talking about, okay? I think. I almost saw the name. Okay, now, this place right here, as we said before, the place of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is right here. At this time, the wall came down like this. They would have let him out this way here. And the road would have come in here. There was a stone. It's an abandoned quarry. I mean, there had been a quarry. You can't see it today. I mean, you can go down underneath and see it. But to look at it today, it looks gaudy. It looks religious, gaudy, like, oh my gosh. Let's go out here to the garden. This looks more like, this is the place you want to be. This is what you have in your mind. But when you get here, you've got 2,000 years of church history built on top of this thing, and it smells like incense. You've got Latins or Romans there, Roman Catholics. You've got Greek Orthodox. You've got pilgrims from all around the world. It's like it's a good thing they got incense there because it's dark, it's smelly, it's ancient. It's got Crusader building on top of it that was destroyed by the Muslims when they actually destroyed the place that Constantine had built, and it's just all built on top of itself. So you get there and go, in fact, when we were there the first time, I'm not sure how, when you guys were there, the first time we went there, I walked in and go, no way, this is nuts. No. And it's like, I didn't even take any pictures. I completely turned off. It's like, you're kidding me. I didn't come all the way. This is not, no. And I went back home. I went back to the hotel room, started doing some research, and Rita's like, oh my gosh, this is the place. So I went back the next day and a couple more times. We went back in 2010 and 2012. And then I started taking pictures of it and started going down deep into it. And we went there one morning when there's no one there. And we got into all kinds of places. And it's like, I'm convinced this is a place. Not just archaeologically, but when we start reading the literature from early church history, Constantine, now I can go off and spend an hour talking about this. You don't have to accept what I'm saying. But there is no doubt in my mind that this is the place of the crucifixion. Because the wall was here. They would let him out to this abandoned quarry. There's quarry stones, limestone quarry there that they would have used. But it got all the good stuff out. The archaeology, I couldn't tell this, but archaeologists say it had been covered up with soil. The quarry had actually, at some time, it had been covered up with soil and turned into a garden, which matches this time. There are tombs that we can still see cut in the bedrock there. And Joseph of Arimathea had been cutting himself a tomb. This has to be outside the wall. There are tombs there. So they had to be outside the wall. They're not going to bury people in the city. By 40 AD, they had to expand this. Okay? And so the city's expanded. So this now, the burial place of Jesus now, within a few years, is inside the city walls. Of course, then they started having to bury people outside the walls. So many things I could say here. But basically, when it was covered up, when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, and then in 135 AD, during the second Jewish revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt, Hadrian came in and built a shrine over the top of the Temple Mount. He also built a shrine over this. You can they built a shrine over this and put statues. It was a place of pagan worship to desecrate this place and bury it. Constantine comes back in 325 AD and asks the people of Jerusalem, the Christians, where is Jesus' burial? Now remember, at that time, this place is in the city walls. It's under a pagan shrine buried for 200 years, since 135 AD. It's been buried. And they say, it's under there. You understand? It's like, no, it's not. That's a pagan shrine. No, it's not. It's inside the city walls. They says, it's in there. So they tore off the pagan shrine, and they found the quarry. They found all the tombs. And that's when Constantine builds the original Church of the Holy Sepulchre, a brilliant building that then the Muslims come by around 700, destroy it, tear it down, and chipped away because, I got to quit talking. But they had, at that time, you could still see the tomb of Jesus, the rock formation that they tunneled in. They just tore it down. And the only reason the burial bench was left intact was because it was covered up in rubble. So when the Crusaders come by, because this place had been desecrated by the Muslims, not the sole reason, but part of the crusade, was all the holy sites are being destroyed by Muslims. Stay with me, folks. All the holy sites in 900, 1000 AD were being destroyed by the Muslims. And so the Christians say, and plus they're being invaded, plus Rome's being invaded, they got to build walls because the Muslims are attacking the Vatican, the Church of St. Peter. And it's like, they had to give them money. Go away, we'll give you money, just go away. Okay, we'll take the money, go away, we'll come back tomorrow. This is because of, you want to blame America? Maybe, I don't know, but it's like, that's what they were doing. And so one of the reasons the Crusades was to come and reclaim the holy sites, and the Crusaders come back, they pull off the rubble and they try, and what you see today is what the Crusaders had built to rebuild Constantine's Holy Sepulchre. In fact, the pillars that are in there are the ones that Constantine had used, and they stood them back up, but they're like half the size of Constantine's. And you can still, you see the tops and bottoms of them are being used in the Crusader. And they found the burial bench. You can still see it, but you can't, because now they make way for Christian pilgrims, and part of the treaties with the Muslims after the Crusades and during the Crusades was the pilgrims could have travel back and forth. Thus, the Templar Knights of the Templar, help me out here, to protect the pilgrims coming to visit. And you know what they did? Just like you and I, when we would go and we said, "This is the actual burial bench," what would you do? Take a chunk of it home. And they chipped off. And so now the burial bench is a slab of marble because the actual burial bench was not destroyed by the Muslims or destroyed with history, but was destroyed by Christian pilgrims taking a chunk of it home. That's fine if you do it, I do it, but if everybody in the world does it, you've got a big dip there. So now there's a marble slab on it, but to keep the Muslims, not today's Muslims, but the Muslims through history from stealing it, it would be very valuable. They split it in half. So now it's two small halves. Not as variable, not worth stealing. But if it was all one slab, they'd take it and put it somewhere else. So they cut it in half in purpose. So you got two stones. And you can see this. You can go in there and you can see it. But again, it's all gaudy. There's all kinds of stuff, trinkets hanging there. There's a big box around it that tries to replicate what was torn down by the Muslims. So you go there, it's like, this is... I walked in, it's like, you're kidding me. Jesus wasn't buried in a big metal box. This is stupid. Then you go back and read the history, like, oh my gosh. 135, Constantine identifies it, the Muslims tear it down, it's there. So that is where Jesus was led for his crucifixion and was buried in a tomb. And you can see the tombs there. You go back deep enough, you can see the tombs. You go deep enough, you can see the bedrock. You go deep enough, you can see temple stones that were torn off the Temple Mount built in the foundation of the 135 Hadrian pagan temple. In other words, when they would rebuild stuff in church later on, like even in 135, when the Romans built this pagan shrine on the Golgotha and the tomb of Christ, they used rubble. They used temple stones from the temple. And at the very bottom, you can see Herodian stones that were used by the Romans to build this Roman shrine that was then built over again by Constantine. I go on and on. Read, if you want to, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Jerusalem book, and you can get more details. And also in there is quotes from church history, including Eusebius and others that are writing in 300, 325, 350. They're writing about the details. So it's not just us talking in the 21st century. We can listen to people talking at these different times, and it all lines up. Not a bit.
not a big deal. It doesn't matter where Jesus died. It doesn't matter where Jesus was buried. You understand? That's not the point. It's just exciting to me that it's historic and that you can trace it back. And these events, these documents, this story, these characters, these conversations are not legends. Jesus came to testify to the truth. This is the truth. There is absolute reality. And part of that absolute truth is Jesus died. And if that's absolutely true, there should be some evidence of it. And it's there if you want. You say, what is truth? Who knows? Well, go your way then. You know, make your choice. Jesus says, those who are on the side of truth, follow him. They come to that point and they follow him. Again, I'm giving you some archaeological evidence. If you disagree with it, you want to go here to the Garden Tomb, say that's fine too, but you got some archaeological. You can feel the presence of God. It's peaceful. There's birds chirping. There's not a lot of incense being burnt, but it's a 700 BC tomb that doesn't match at all. But who wants the details? Let's just go with what we felt. I'm going to pray, and you're free to go. Thank you for enduring. Father, do thank you again for this chance to look into your word. We thank you for what Jesus Christ has done. We ask that we would again reflect his nature, his character, and his truth in our own lives, that you would empower us by your Spirit to be committed to the truth, to stand for the truth, and be able to bear testimony to the world in our own lives. In Jesus' name we ask this. Thank you for letting us be Christians, and thank you for giving us a future kingdom that we can be part of. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thanks for your time.